This is The Reason Interview, where we go deep with the artists, entrepreneurs, policymakers, and academics who are making the world more libertarian, or at least a little more interesting. I'm Eric Boehm, filling in for Nick Gillespie. This week, our guest is Lauren Hall, a political science professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology and the author of The Radical Moderate's Guide to Life on Substack, where she encourages readers to reject binary thinking and keep politics out of their lives as much as possible. Lauren's work focuses on tribalism and political polarization, examining, studying, and researching where it comes from, why it's so powerful, and how we can fight back against it. She has become increasingly alarmed by the populist impulses that are central to American politics on both the right and the left, and by how the political elites are using those trends to make the lesser of two evils feel like the only choice voters truly have. In our conversation, Hall explained what it means to be a radical moderate, and why that could be the solution to America's broken political compass. She also discussed the diverse and unusual influences that have shaped her approach to political philosophy and what she wasn't prepared for from this second Trump administration. And now, The Reason Interview with Lauren Hall. Lauren Hall, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
So you are a professor of political science at the Rochester Institute of Technology, but you also write a Substack, which is how I first learned about you and came to appreciate your work and your thinking. The Radical Moderate's Guide to Life is the name of the Substack. I think that's also going to be the name of a planned forthcoming book that you're working on. Yep. So we got to start with the big obvious question here. Radical moderation. What is it and why is it radical?
Yeah, great question. So when I was first putting the Substack together, you know, I wanted I wanted a phrase that sort of caught readers' attention. And obviously radical moderation is a bit of an oxymoron. But I think it actually means something really important. And so part of what I think we're struggling with when it comes to defenses of political centrism or political moderation is this sense that moderation is sort of, you know, you take the Democratic Party, you take the Republican Party, and then you just pick a middle point, right? But if both of these points on the extremes are terrible, there's no reason that the middle will be better than either of those extremes, right? And part of this, I think, is this broader metaphor I'm playing with in the Substack is that we need to get out of this one-dimensional binary view of politics that we have right versus left. And in fact, we need to really explode that altogether and really think about politics in all four dimensions. So the radical moderation that the reason it's radical is that it's an explosion of this traditional one-dimensional binary, this traditional way of understanding the political spectrum. But it's also moderate because it asks us to really dig into the complexity and nuance of the policy world, of the political world. I talk a lot about parenting. I think that we've really sort of pigeonholed ourselves in a lot of these like black and white binaries about how the human social world operates. And it's leading us to really terrible policy. It's leading us to really terrible political decisions and sort of broader, issues with democratic rhetoric and I think real dangers to liberal institutions.
Yeah, I think that's something that really appeals to libertarians, certainly appeals to me, because it's like when you look at the world outside of politics, you almost never have this binary choice, right? Like you have, yeah. I mean, maybe you have Coke and Pepsi, I guess, but there's still other alternatives even there, right? But you have this proliferation of choices that we've had in the last, certainly in my lifetime, but really over the last 100 years. And yet politics, it seems like we're still stuck in this binary that you talk about. So I guess contrast for me what it is that you're talking about versus just old school basic centrism, because that's not really the point you're getting at. You're not saying let's find a middle ground between these two sides. It's not bipartisanship that you're proposing. You're proposing kind of a rethinking of the mental maps of politics that we have in our brains.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's kind of two things going on. One is I think broadly politically, we're seeing a realignment. More Americans are considering themselves sort of politically homeless. For the first time, sort of 43 to 44% of Americans identify as independent. That's a huge shift away from this sort of binary way of thinking about politics. So I think we're seeing people who are increasingly frustrated with the quote unquote solutions, and they're not solutions at all that are on offer by the sort of the two major parties. And so I think that in terms of like how people think about their political identity, they've always been more complex than the two party system, but we've just forced them into those spaces. But the second thing I think is that we see that, and this again is sort of a move away from sort of centrism as just this point, the sort of midpoint on this line between Republicans and Democrats or between the left and the right. I think a lot of solutions out there are much, much better discussed in terms of this broad landscape, in terms of nuance and complexity and understanding both individual level choice and these broader structures. So I'll just give one quick example. You know, I think the sort of binary choices that we saw with between, say, Black Lives Matter and Blue Lives Matter when it comes to criminal justice reform. And this is something that I think libertarians have been doing really well, except no one listens for years, right? Which is, you know, it's not about choosing, right? And it's not like you choose this centrist point that like, well, you know, Black Lives Matter a bit and Blue Lives Matter a bit. Like, that's not the right moral position to be in. The best moral position to be in is a space where you don't have to choose between Black Americans and police officers, right? And I think that there's a lot of evidence from criminal justice reform that we could make common sense reforms of policing, of the broader criminal justice system that actually saves police lives and saves the lives of Black Americans, lower income Americans, folks struggling with addiction, mental health. And so, but that's not going to be something that you find by just sort of taking the left and the right and sticking yourself right in the middle. That's a conversation that has to happen in this much broader four-dimensional space.
You mentioned how more Americans now identify as independents than ever before. And when people do polling on, you know, do you think we need a third party in this country? It seems like, you know, there's majorities of Americans that say, yes, we need a third party. The problem, though, as like a political matter, is that that group of people never seems to be able to agree on exactly what it is they want, what it is they want that third party to look like, or what they think an ideal independent candidate would be. I get that like exploding the binary is an important step towards solving some of these bigger picture problems in our politics. But then there is the like the nitty gritty problem, right, of like those people don't actually agree on what it is they want that third choice to look like. And maybe that's OK. Like, is that OK? We just have a proliferation of choices, maybe.
Yeah, I actually don't even think third parties are the way to go. And I think that we have an enormous number of incentives within the political system right now that push against third parties. I mean, it's just, so there's different levers that we can pull. And I think third parties are one, but they're not the ideal because there's so many friction points working against their success. You know, just the entire sort of winner-take-all system, the primaries, all of the ways that we structure our elections in the United States. So rather than focusing on political parties, I actually think that there's a lot of, and I have a podcast, we made this political with Laura Forkum, who's the president of the Independent Center. She's doing a lot of work, and the Independent Center broadly is doing a lot of work on mobilizing independent voters, not to vote for third parties, but to place pressure on the political parties that right now are deeply non-representative. And so to your original question, which is people don't seem to know what they want. I actually think people do know what they want. It's that the political parties are not providing that solution, right? So people want affordable housing. They want safer streets, right? They want a working immigration system. And so right now, the two parties have diametrically opposed sort of ways of thinking about those problems, but they're ways of thinking about those problems that are deeply partisan and that are actually not solutions at all. They're just sort of like solutions that prop up the party machine in a variety of different ways. And this goes to this broader sort of pattern that I've been thinking about a lot, which is that if you look at polling data across the board and polarization data, elites are much more polarized than the average American. The average American actually is relatively, I mean, we're not unified on the specific policy details, but we're pretty unified in terms of like the direction that we want things to go. And so that's where I think we're just failing deeply. I mean, if you look at the housing crisis, there's no one is providing the actual solutions. People know what the solution is, build more homes, but no one's actually doing, they're not pulling the policy levers to do that.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to ask you about. Actually, that comes up in your writing quite a bit, that this polarization is really like an elite driven phenomenon, even though I think in politics and in punditry, we talk about it as there's a rise in populism kind of on both the right and the left, which implies, or at least has historically meant, that this is like an upwelling from below. And but you're kind of saying that, well, no, it's not that. It's actually being driven by the people who are in power on both the right and left are driving this polarization. I think that's really important to understand. Can you just like unpack that a little bit more for us?
Yeah. And this is not to say that there isn't. I mean, I think that it's really easy to animate populist sentiments in population. So it's not to say that there isn't a bottom-up element to this. But I think what we're seeing is a real top-down failure. Certainly we have, since 2016, we've had a president who had, you know, with the 4 years in between, but like we've had a major political figure who is intentionally divisive, right? Who is intentionally inflammatory, and who sort of tries as hard as he can to animate tribalism and the sort of more negative side of populism. So I think that is something that it's sort of latent in the population at all times, but it's much more likely to be animated when you have a powerful person triggering those instincts. So that's the first thing. But I think the other thing that I keep coming back to is that we are asking citizens to operate with systems that are not by themselves liberal systems. They were not sort of democratically constructed. They are not, they don't align with any kind of real rational basis for anything. A lot of my policy work focuses on healthcare. And so if you're talking to the average American about their experience with the healthcare system, it's completely opaque. It doesn't make any sense, right? Why it's set up the way it's set up, why the incentives are the way that they are. It's highly corporatized because we've created this sort of web of regulations that essentially crowds out small providers, crowds out these other kinds of alternatives. And so when it comes to people looking at the system and thinking, you know, well, this whole system was not created via sort of the liberal democratic process. It was actually sort of created in these backdoor kinds of cronyist, back rooms. It kind of makes sense to me that people will get more and more disaffected with the sort of democratic levers that they have, because they're not enough to dismantle the kind of dysfunction that elites have allowed to proliferate. And so I think there's kind of a couple things happening. There's the sort of the systems level failures. But then if you look at elite institutions across the board, and we can dig into this as much as you know, I think this is going to be a big part of our conversation. I think we've had failures in the media. We've had failures of universities. I think those institutions have allowed themselves to be polarized and, in fact, encourage polarization. And so I see a lot more top-down pressure than I do bottom-up.
And I think something, just to kind of summarize this section of things, like it seems like you're saying, and your project is sort of geared towards people have a lot of good ideas or have a lot of good thoughts about the way things should work in politics. And then it's only when you kind of try to squeeze them into the political system, when you have to go in the voting booth and make a choice between red or blue and all of the, you know, context around that, that forces people to make a choice between two things that are probably neither of the things they actually want. You write about the, like, the way the political compass, are like this mental map that we have of politics, is sort of broken. I want to talk about the tribalism point too, but before we get to that, this, like, the idea of, you know, this goes beyond just left-right binary, but there's even the four-way kind of political axis that libertarians like to think about, with like authoritarianism and libertarianism and conservatism and liberalism, even that doesn't really fail to, or even that kind of fails to capture where Americans are when they think about big political problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it also, I think, fails to recognize that one of the problems that we have with these political maps, and I understand from, you know, I'm a political scientist, so I understand why we like mapping things, we like categorizing things, right? It helps us understand the world. But the problem then becomes that people are, and this I think comes back to this broader point of tribalism, which I think we're going to dig into. Humans are heavily identity-based, right? It's really easy to trigger sort of tribalistic impulses. And so when we have these identifiers, right, I am a progressive, or I am a conservative, or I am a libertarian, or I'm a diehard Republican, whatever your specific identifier is. Now, all of a sudden, the kind of policy that you care about is not a policy that actually solves human problems. It's whether that policy fits your identity, right? Is this the narrative that we have about the world? Like, is this the way that we think the world should behave? And I see a lot of libertarians fall into this trap too, but I think it's particularly prevalent among the two major parties because they have this power that they need to preserve. And so once you start thinking about policy in terms of, does it fit my party's narrative or my tribe's narrative? Well, then you're not going to get solutions at all, right? You're going to get, or maybe you'll get solutions accidentally. Whereas I think that when we sort of explode that binary and really think about, let's get into the four dimensions of politics and sort of human social life, well, then what really matters is what actually works on the ground, not what fits some grand ideological narrative. And to be honest, there's going to be specific solutions that will work in some contexts and not in others because people are different and contexts are different.
Yeah. But you want to be a team player, right? Like, I understand the appeal of that. And certainly that's true even for libertarians who like to think we stand outside of that team dynamic. But it's absolutely true for us, too. You've also studied like evolutionary biology, I believe, in some of your background. Like, how does that inform some of the way you look at tribalism? Like, is this, you know, tribalist team nature, you know, activity of politics? Is that just like hardwired into us as human beings? Is that why it's so difficult to get past, even though, you know, we feel like we're, you know, more developed probably than we were, you know, in prehistoric times?
Yeah. So I studied evolutionary biology under David Sloan Wilson at Binghamton when I was an undergrad. And so he does a lot of work in evolution and human behavior. So looking at, again, how sort of our evolutionary past affects the way that we think about the world today. I was actually debating studying evolutionary psychology in grad school and then shifted gears into political theory. But I think that the sort of evolutionary psychology approach really does heavily influence the way that I think about the world, which is that we know, I get people sometimes ask if my focus on context means I'm just sort of a relativist, right? Or just like a pragmatist, like whatever works in this moment's fine, right? I think that's actually not the case. I think part of the reason that liberal institutions and big tent liberal institutions have been so powerful over the last couple centuries is that they work with human nature as opposed to against it, right? They channel human nature in pro-social ways, and they move us away from the sort of more damaging tribalism. But one of the things that I reinforce with my students all the time is that human nature is neither good nor bad. We have a lot of impulses and instincts that can be channeled in pro-social ways or anti-social ways. I do work on the family, the political theory of the family. Family is a wonderful thing. I have three kids. I love families. But families are also the sort of desire to protect your family is also why we have nepotism. And it's one of the major drivers of corruption. I mean, we see this in the Trump administration right now. So I think that everyone, you know, I think we sometimes get into this habit of thinking about sort of human nature as, I think the progressives think about it as kind of perfectible, right? We can sort of move toward this perfectible human nature over time. Conservatives tend to sort of see human nature in line with sort of original sin. But I think if you look at it from the perspective of evolutionary biology, right, like humans are evolved for social living. We have a lot of ways that we have adapted to social living, but we also have, and some of those adaptations can be really positive. Tribalism is actually part of the reason that you feel a sense of community when you're in, you know, when you go to a conference or when you're sort of in your, you know, your church or whatever, right? Like it helps you feel a sense of grounding in the world that you have a place that you belong. But the problem with tribalism is that it creates outgroups, right? If you have an in-group that makes you feel really connected to each other and to sort of your identity, it's really easy then to animate that against other groups. And so that's, I think, what we're seeing right now in terms of toxic tribalism and toxic polarization is that it's not just, here's my group that gives me a lot of meaning. It's now, here's this group that gives me a lot of meaning, and that group over there is actively dangerous to us. Right. So I think evolutionary biology is really crucial to the way that I think about human political institutions and figuring out what kinds of human political institutions help channel that nature in ways that help us flourish together, as opposed to in ways that help increase conflict.
Can you give an example of that? Like, what is a liberal institution that channels human nature in a productive direction rather than like constraining our lesser angels kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, the primary one that that I talk about with students, because they start off with a very negative view of it, is just markets, right? What do markets do, right? They take your self-interest to make your life easier and better, and they give you an incentive to share the value that you have with other people. And so markets are actually this really incredible voluntary collaborative process that's fully bottom up. You actually don't need, I have this hilarious story from when we were, I took a break between college and grad school and moved to Ecuador. And at one point, it's a much longer story. We ended up on a pig boat, going down the Rio Napo, which is a tributary of the Amazon. And we had like a can of Dutch cheese and like a bottle of rum. And that was what we had brought with us. And so we're in these hammocks and we ended up being there for 5 days because the river was low. And we're on this pig boat with a number of indigenous folks who don't speak any Spanish. And we don't, they certainly don't speak English. And I just remember watching this indigenous woman. She has this big bag of oranges, and she's watching us swig out of this bottle of rum, and she holds up the oranges and looks at the rum. And I was like, absolutely, right? So I pass the rum, she passes the oranges, right? This was like completely spontaneous, right? Like we didn't have to, nobody had to direct us like, oh, she has oranges and you have rum, maybe you guys should trade. We just did it spontaneously. We didn't even have to speak the same language. And so I think that's a really good example. And as a libertarian, you're probably very familiar with lots of examples of when you shut down markets, they come out in much more antisocial ways. We get black markets, we get all sorts of additional violence and coercion because they're not allowed to operate in the open air. And so I think that's a really good example of sort of something that if you have relatively free markets with guardrails, that you channel human nature in ways that benefit everybody, right? It's a non-zero sum way of operating. Free speech is another one, right? I mean, I think that people tend to be much more likely to engage in political violence when they feel as though they have no voice, when they feel as though they've been shut down. So, I mean, you know, when I look at sort of the broader political institutions, things like separation of powers, checks and balances, an independent judiciary, right? All of those things cropped up over time and they evolved over hundreds of years because people discovered that they work. They work to reduce conflict and encourage cooperation and collaboration. And that's really what you want. And so the more that we can channel the positive aspects of human nature into these outlets, the better off we are.
Hey, Reason listeners. Want to help a student think clearly in the age of AI? Reliance College invites students age 16 to 24 to the Great Connections Weekend Seminar, Reason and Power, January 9th through the 11th, 2026, at the Hilton Houston Plaza Medical Center. This immersive three-day experience builds the skills that no algorithm can replace: clear reasoning, persuasive communication, and independent thought. Students will explore great works by Ayn Rand, Epictetus, Machiavelli, and more in small dynamic groups, developing the habits of mind that drive real innovation. This isn't a lecture. It's a conversation that changes how you think. Registration is just $99.99 with scholarships available. Learn more and apply at reliancecollege.org/seminar. That's reliancecollege.org/seminar. I love the story about the rum and the oranges. That's fantastic.
It's amazing.
You're totally right about like the way in which, you know, obviously there's problems when you shut down markets. We're seeing a lot of that now. We will talk about President Trump. I know you have some thoughts on that, too. We'll get to that a little bit later. I want to just sort of put a bow on this whole thing with the markets point made me also go back and think about the tribalism thing. Right. Like, I think everybody understands that sort of transaction, right? The trade that happened on that boat, or when I go downtown and I buy, you know, something from a local store, I understand that I'm trading my money for something that they made. Everybody wins in that transaction. For some reason, for a lot of people, it seems like that breaks down once you start thinking about, you know, it's not you buying something from your neighbor or in your community, but you start thinking about like international trade, right? It's the same dynamic, but much larger and with people that you don't know. And then it seems like it's somehow easier for the political system then to turn people against something that on a fundamental level, we would all agree with. Like trade is good. You're better off because you had the orange, because you were able to make that trade. Why does that happen? Why is tribalism messing with my ability to buy stuff, Lauren?
Well, I think this goes to the sort of omnipresence of politics right now. And so I was actually in a conversation yesterday with a group of political scientists talking sort of broadly about, liberal democracy and sort of what we're going to do. And one of the things that group kind of pointed to is that the average citizen actually does not want to think about politics as much as they do. They don't want, they like, we're embroiled in all of these national conversations that have no impact on how people are actually living their lives. All they do is they add to anxiety. And I'll say that some political conversations do, of course, have impacts on how people live their lives. But 90% of sort of the drama that comes at us from the political sphere right now is completely meaningless, right? It's just sort of like various, I mean, it's the equivalent of sort of like water cooler gossip. And most Americans actually don't want to think about politics. They just want governance institutions to function, right? They just want to be able to do, they want to be able to move about their world and achieve their ends without constantly stubbing their toes against, you know, unnecessary regulations or failed systems or whatever, you know, whatever kinds of friction points they're facing. And so I think, you know, that's another good example of how the media, I think, plays a really enormous role in sort of centralizing politics in people's brains, as well as sort of the negativity bias that the current media landscape has because it's so fragmented. But I think, you know, one thing that we know about tribalistic impulses is that they're very easy to turn on and off. And so one of the things that the Trump administration's been sort of unfortunately really successful at is playing these in-group and out-group dynamics against each other. So in the 2016 election, Trump really focused on immigration. Immigration is a really easy thing to activate that tribalistic instinct because immigrants are by definition a sort of outgroup in most countries. And so if you can argue that immigrants are dangerous or that their economic, you know, sucks on the, you know, they're sucking the economy dry. It's really easy for people to say, oh, well, that's a group that we shouldn't support. Let's get, you know, let's get them sort of out of our communities. So to your point, I think it's really, it makes a lot of sense that because politics now occupies this outside, you know, this outsized space in the media and in sort of the broader landscape, that now becomes the identity on which people activate. And I think to the sort of broader point about markets, I think we're seeing this as a real failure in a number of ways, where it used to be that you just go to the local diner because it's the local diner and you like their coffee or whatever, where it's convenient. And I'm seeing an increasing number of people, you know, say things like, well, I know that the owner of that diner voted for Trump, so I'm no longer going to go there. And so what ends up happening is we're now politicizing non-political spaces. We're politicizing civil society spaces, which are the areas that we actually connect with each other in meaningful ways. And we're corrupting these institutions like markets and preventing them from doing the stuff that they would otherwise be doing, which is helping us collaborate and cooperate in nonviolent ways. So it's a real, it's a real problem. And there's all these knock-on effects that we are not seeing.
Yeah, this has been a depressing conversation so far, but I think we'll get to some solutions. I hope we'll get to some solutions. This is the recent interview with Nick Gillespie, and like, I'm not Nick Gillespie, but one of the things that he always talks about when he interviews people, he always wants to know like where people come from, what their background is. And I think that's really insightful because it's always like really integral either to who somebody is or what they're trying to get away from, maybe like that. So I want to pivot the conversation a little bit here, Lauren. Like when you were 12 years old, you probably didn't want to grow up to become a professor of political science. I don't know, maybe you did, but what, like, what activated you into doing the work that you're doing now? How did you get on this path? How did you end up on a pig boat in South America?
That's a harder one to answer. So I actually had this conversation with myself a couple years ago because I was sort of confused about why I had taken this pivot into thinking about sort of polarization and pluralism. My other work was not really in that space. But the more that I thought about it, the more I realized that I actually have this deep sort of developmental understanding of pluralism that can help other people see the world in, I think, a slightly different way. So my background is like very, very weird. I grew up, my dad's a conservative libertarian. My mom, for most of my childhood, would have been probably identified as like a blue dog Democrat. Both my parents are practicing Zen Buddhists. So I grew up going to a Zen Sunday school. And then I grew up in a largely Jewish town, and I grew up with cousins who are Mormon. And so I grew up like going to, you know, bat mitzvahs, and then also to the Mormon church after sleepovers, and also had this Zen, you know, this sort of like religious, focus on Zen Buddhism. And I think what that background offered was a really early, sort of informal education in how to talk to people and how to interact with people who are very different from you. And I saw my parents model that, I think, really well. But I think part of what that sort of got me interested in is sort of just broader questions about human nature. And so when I went to undergrad, I got really interested in evolutionary biology. I was a philosophy major with this sort of minor in evolutionary biology. And then I stumbled into political theory because it was one space that I could combine my interest in evolutionary theory with political sort of understanding political systems. But I think broadly speaking, the thing that really animates me is just understanding how humans work together to lead better lives, right? I'm really interested in this question of like sort of human sociality, which runs so deep, and yet it can go off the rails so easily. And trying to understand how we prevent it from going off the rails to prevent, you know, widespread human suffering. You know, there's all sorts of lessons that we need to learn that we have not yet, for a variety of reasons, learned.
Are you a Buddhist? Do you consider yourself Buddhist? Are you religious at all? Does that enter into your thinking of and the way you see the world?
No, to add like another layer of complexity, I actually converted to Catholicism in 2019. Okay. And that there's a whole background to that too. Sort of, I became really enamored of sort of the Catholic intellectual tradition. And then there was this broader conversion experience. And so, yeah, so now I'm in this very weird space where I have, you know, like about half my siblings, I think if they identify as anything, are probably atheists. I'm Catholic. My parents are still practicing Zen Buddhists. My husband's a lapsed Catholic. And then we have this broader, you know, LDS contingent. I mean, there's all these sort of, you know.
Sounds like a really interesting Thanksgiving table or New Year's gathering, something like that. Yeah.
So to this point, I mean, it's kind of funny to me that people often talk about how, you know, you want to not talk about politics and or religion, you know, in sort of polite society or at the Thanksgiving table. But one of the things that was a characteristic of my family is that we talked about almost nothing but politics and religion. And part of that was that, you know, my family was really intellectually curious and we liked to talk about ideas, but I think one of the things that my parents modeled is that you can discuss the ideas without attacking the person. Mm. And that was something that I had to learn. I mean, it doesn't mean that it was like instinctive or anything. But I think that there is a way in which we've lost that ability. Now we discuss ideas and somehow those ideas activate this tribalism. And now we're defensive and we're angry and the conversation goes nowhere.
Yeah, that sounds very familiar to me. I was actually raised Catholic. I went the other direction. I'm like a lapsed Catholic now, but I mean, maybe I'll end up as a Buddhist someday. Who knows? But the that idea was really integral to when I was growing up and my family and the discussions we would have too, was like you can have debates about ideas without attacking people. And that really does seem like it's missing these days. Yeah. And I wonder if that's politics, if it's social media, probably plays a role in some of that. You spend a lot of time with college students and younger people. And like, do you see, is there a different level of intellectual engagement there? Or are the fears about that kind of overblown?
I actually am worried. My campus is a unique campus because it's a STEM school. And so we don't have a lot of the heavy politicization that other universities have. But we actually have the sort of flip side of that, which is that it's really hard to get my students to engage in conversations about ideas in general, because they're scared might be too strong of a word, but it also might not be too strong of a word. They're scared of each other. And they're also really worried about hurting people's feelings. So they cannot handle conflict. They don't know how to deal with people who are fundamentally different from them other than by saying, hey, I'm okay, you're okay. It's okay. We're just not going to talk about it. Right? That's their way of sort of handling pluralism. And I think that's the worst way of handling pluralism, right? You know, one of the things that I found most frustrating was for a while there was that sort of progressive, I don't know if it was like Tumblr that first started this, but it became politically incorrect to ask people where they're from, because it would somehow, you know, it would indicate that they're an other, or, and I can totally understand that if you're born in the United States and you, you know, are asked constantly where you're from, it, that can be obnoxious. But when I'm in an Uber with, you know, a West African who clearly is an immigrant, I want to hear his story. I want to ask him, you know, how he got here. And, you know, when I hear Spanish speakers, because I used to be much more fluent in Spanish than I am now, I want to talk to them about where they're from, where, like, because I've been to a ton of South American countries. I want to talk to them about that. And so it really frustrated me that there was this sort of pulling back of, we really want, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, but you can't ask people questions about their identities. You can't ask, you can't get curious about other people. You can't dig into the pluralism that surrounds us, without, you know, engaging in microaggressions or having some other kind of, you know, negative effect. So my students have really, I think, absorbed that. And most of them just don't want to speak up at all. They're really uncomfortable talking about sort of differences in that way, with a very small exception, which is the students who are just professional trolls, right? And so they're the ones who have, like, imbibed this, like, broader kind of troll culture where they just want to engage with people to get people angry or riled up. And so those are the extremes we're working with. And I don't think either of them are terribly productive.
I wonder if that's just the other side of the same coin of, like, if you can't separate ideas from people, right? If attacking an idea is the same as attacking a person, then the way to avoid that conflict is just to not talk about ideas at all, because it's going to, right? Like, that's kind of what's happening there.
Yes, I think that's right.
Yeah, not to microaggress against you, but the next thing I was going to ask you is you're in Rochester now. Is that where you're from? Where are you from?
Yeah, I actually am from Rochester, which is weird. I grew up in Brighton, which is a suburb of Rochester, has a large Jewish population, as I mentioned before. A lot of pluralism in terms of just how people think about both religion, but also a fair amount of ethnic diversity. Not a lot of racial diversity. Rochester is a weird place. We have this deeply segregated city center, and the suburbs are largely white. I ended up getting a job back. I went away for college and grad school, did not anticipate coming back to Rochester. When I got a job back in Rochester, I was a little bummed out because I had thought it might be fun to be somewhere else for a while. And then I met my husband, who had also boomeranged back. So we're now in the weird position of having both sets of grandparents who are still alive and living in town with us. My brother boomeranged back from DC. So we have cousins in town with us. So it's kind of this, I joke that it's a golden handcuff situation. You know, we'll be stuck here for the next, like, decade and a half. But it's been a really wonderful place to be.
Sooner or later, everybody ends up back in Rochester. I ask about that, though, because I lived there for just very briefly for a summer right after college while I was working an internship at the newspaper there. And this was like 2009. I think that was probably around the time when Rochester seemed to have bottomed out after Kodak Eastman. I mean, it was my sense is that the city has come back a little bit now from where it was then. But I want you to give us a little more sense of what it's like living there in Rochester, because this is part of the Rust Belt. It doesn't get talked about as much as, like, Pennsylvania and Ohio, just for political reasons, because New York isn't a swing state. But culturally, it's very much part of this Rust Belt, Great Lakes area that is now so central to the populism we were talking about earlier, that's so central to some of the ideas on both the right and left that seem to be driving things in that political binary. Do you get the sense that, like, I don't know, Donald Trump's politics have connected with people in upstate New York in a way that just isn't reflected on electoral maps? Or is there, well, like, what's the vibe that you get from living in Rochester? Give me a sense of that.
Yeah. So, I mean, clearly the Rochester and upstate New York generally follow the same pattern as most other states, which is that the cities are blue. So the city of Rochester is blue, and then the suburbs are purple. And then once you get out into the rural areas, it's heavily red. So if you drive out of Rochester, you'll see Trump signs on, you know, these rural lawns, and there's a lot of Trump supporters. And this is one thing that I find frustrating about the winner take all sort of aspect of politics, is that you would think that New York, if you looked at the electoral map, as you just pointed out, you would think that New York's this heavily blue, like, everyone's Democratic, right? But in reality, the sort of people who really succeed in politics in New York, apart from downstate, I think New York City is its own kind of space. But in the rest of the state, right, you actually have to be a kind of political centrist to get stuff done, because there is this clear, kind of polarization between rural voters and urban voters. And so the question, of course, is like, where do you put resources? How do you think about resource scarcity in this broader context? Rochester and Buffalo are also unfortunately unique because we do have this weird history of segregation. And I didn't realize this until recently that Rochester was not part of the Great Migration, despite being the home of Frederick Douglass, despite being the home of Susan B. Anthony and other folks like that. It was not part of this Great Migration from the South because Eastman Kodak had rules against hiring Black Americans. And so people just knew that they weren't going to be able to get jobs in Rochester. So they went to other places in the Northeast. So the wave of Black migration that we got was actually migrant farm workers. And they initially settled on the outskirts of town. But so they were kind of, as opposed to the intellectual Great Migration of, you know, Black intellectuals sort of bringing their, you know, gifts and talents from the South and moving north, we got a population that was already very vulnerable. And that vulnerability has just continued over time. And so Rochester and Buffalo both got the sort of dubious distinction of being the two most segregated public school systems in the nation. And so there's a lot of just structural things that are really hard to get around. So I think we've got the polarization, we've got a lot of racial, I don't know if animosity is the right word. It's like there's very little racial interaction. And a lot of that's class-based as well. And so it's just like a very odd space in that sense. At the same time, I will say that I think you're absolutely right that 2009 was probably a bottoming out. And now it's really, I think, grown quite a lot. More young people are staying. More young people are moving into the city. I think we have better leadership. We had like a string of kind of corrupt, we had a couple really good mayors and then a string of sort of not that great mayors. Now I think we're back in good mayor land. But yeah, so I mean, I think all of these mid-sized cities are struggling in very similar ways. They don't get the attention of the large cities, but they also don't get a lot of the funding that really impoverished areas, for example, like rural areas get. And so, they're just mid-sized cities, right? They're just sort of trying their best to attract, you know, talented workers and people who want to build families there. At the same time, I think there's a lot of benefits to, and we saw this actually during the pandemic, Rochester had an influx of people come from New York City because we had affordable housing and we have backyards. And so I had friends in Brooklyn who were just desperate to get out of the city during COVID because it was such a disaster. So I think people are realizing that there's benefits to mid-sized cities, particularly in terms of housing. But I don't know what that's going to look like long term.
Yeah, I feel like that's one of the big solutions to housing is just to be like, I saw a post this week about how Wichita, Kansas, the average rent is like $1,000 or something. It's like those other cities are out there, folks. Not everybody has to live in New York or D.C. New York's great, obviously. D.C. not so much. But like, go explore the rest of the country, too, young people.
Yes.
We got to pivot here. We got to talk about Trump because every political conversation in America in the year 2025 has to talk about Donald Trump. You wrote what I thought was a really interesting piece on your Substack about how you underestimated the threat of Donald Trump to liberal institutions. I want to talk about that, but I guess before we can understand what you underestimated about him, give me your mindset. You're somewhat Trump weary is what I've gathered from this conversation, but give me your mindset of, you know, a year ago, it's just after the election. Okay, we've got to do this again. Trump 2.0 is coming. Yep. What did you expect and how has it differed from what you expected?
This might be my eternal optimism, in this case, failing me. But after the election, I wrote a series of Substack posts. I was obviously very disheartened. I was worried. I mean, neither candidate was great, let's be honest. But I did think that Trump, was a sort of distinctly more dangerous kind of person than Harris was. Although I have very complicated feelings on that, on like the policy level. I think there's like a norms and institutions conversation that we can have and then a policy conversation. And I actually think it's important to separate those two things. But certainly on the norms and institution level, I think he was quite dangerous. But one of the things that I saw immediately after the election was just this, the sort of toxic polarization kind of skyrocketed. And I had friends on social media who were like, I'm cutting off all Trump voters, you know, my family, friends, because you have shown that you're a racist. You have shown that you're a bigot. You have shown that you're transphobic. And I thought to myself, like, what a weird way of trying to like protect vulnerable populations by like calling like the people that you will eventually need to like find a coalition with, you know, calling them racist, bigots. Like that's really counterproductive, but it's also inaccurate. Like if you look at the reason that most Trump voters voted for Trump, it was a combination of the system's so broken that we just need to break things. He's a businessman and the economy is bad, even though it wasn't that bad, but you know, inflation was obviously a problem. And the Democrats don't seem to care about that. So we can trust this businessman. You know, so it's not to say that there weren't incorrect, it's not that voters weren't wrong about aspects of Trump, but the vast majority of people who voted for Trump are not, in fact, bigots and they're not racists. They were willing to overlook a lot. But that's not the same as being like a white supremacist. And that's where I saw people moving. And my concern, of course, is that now we've heightened the sort of tribalist sort of like thermometer to the point that people can't even talk to people who voted for the other side. And the same thing happened on the right as well. People talking about, you know, people who voted for Harris as though they're, you know, communists a la Stalin or something.
And I wonder how many people who voted for Trump thought, well, the institutions kind of constrained him and held him, you know, maybe not entirely, but mostly during the first term. And they maybe use that as a reason to look past some of the threat because, oh, he won't actually be able to do the things he's doing. That maybe is not holding up as well the second time around, but
This is the mistake that I made. So and by the way, it's a mistake in the sense that it was sort of like an epistemological error, but it didn't affect the way I behaved in the world. So I don't think I would have changed anything, even if I had realized sort of how things were going to move. But I did not anticipate the organization of the Heritage Foundation in 2025. I did not realize that they were spending 4 years, more than 4 years, really, like putting this infrastructure into place. I think it's crazy that Democrats didn't realize that. And I also think it's crazy that Democrats after 2016 didn't take stock and think, hey, let's put into place an actual strategy, like a winning strategy to figure out how to make sure this doesn't happen again. They clearly did not do that in any kind of way. And so that's another reason we're stuck in this situation. But I do think that, you know, the Trump administration, the first one, it was constrained by institutions, it was constrained by norms, and it was constrained by people in the room who cared about those institutions and norms. You know, there's this great quote from Machiavelli that talks about sort of, you know, a people's, that ultimately all government rests on opinion. Right. And what he meant by that, of course, is that like you can be a really great ruler, but if the people turn against you, it doesn't matter if their opinion's accurate or it's not. Right. What really matters is the way that people think about you and sort of your institutions. And so we had people who cared about liberal institutions in the Trump administration. He obviously did not like that. And so second round, he made sure that none of them were there. And so, you know, so we've seen this crumbling of the judiciary. We've seen, you know, just obvious attacks on civil rights and civil liberties, attacks on free speech in the name of free speech, which is always sort of odd to me. And just a variety of other, you know, erosions. So, so I think I did not anticipate the 2025, the Project 2025 element.
Do you think that pendulum might already be swinging back the other way? Some of the polling on, like, say, the tariffs, it's something like 75% of Americans say Trump's signature policy has raised costs at this point, like in the limited election results that we saw in New Jersey and Virginia and New York. Yeah. What is the radical moderates' plan for Democrats maybe going into the midterm? What's the advice here for them as they've got the advantage, it would seem like, on the field at the moment? Don't overreach, though.
Yes. Yeah. First of all, don't take anything for granted. I think part of what Democrats are often often sort of motivated by is they have this sort of belief that history. I mean, I think after Trump lost, they were like, whew, glad that's over. That was like a historical blip. Like it never occurred to them that he could win a second term. Right. And I think that's a deeply dangerous thing to think. Right. Like history is not progressive in some like deep, big H way. It just it's humans like doing what humans do. So first of all, get rid of the idea that like this is not, you know, there's some like inevitability to like progressive leadership. And then I think they just need to really move away from the culture war stuff and focus on housing, a working immigration system, right? Like focus on the things that people actually care about, affordability, housing, and, you know, get some bipartisan proposals for immigration reform on the table. And I think you would get a much, you know, a much more, I think you'd see better results.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point you make about like the capital H history, right? Like the sweeping arc of history. This is something that I think liberals are particularly given to believing in, right? And you can see the this was rhetoric during the Obama administration, right? That like the arc of, and I mean, calling back to the civil rights movement, the idea that the arc of justice moves in a certain way, or the arc of history moves in a certain way, that certain people are on the right side or the wrong side of history. And I mean, the last 10 years seem to blow up any belief in that. And yet I think that is still, we want to believe that, right? We want to think that that we're perfecting the union over time. But I mean, to your point, this is like, it takes work to keep doing this. This is not something that happens on its own.
And conservatives, by the way, they have their own, you know, I think a lot of the conservative sort of emphasis on tradition and, you know, the nuclear family, things like this. I mean, I think conservatives think that there's this baseline of, you know, nuclear family, the woman stays home, the man works, right? Like everyone's married, right? So I think they have this, like, they think that history is going to return to this natural quote unquote baseline. And so they have their own sort of sense of like where things are going to automatically move if they can kind of like help them along. And I think both are wrong, right? Like human social systems, including the family, are highly context dependent and highly open to, you know, they're highly responsive to incentives. And so if you think any one outcome is inevitable, then you're doing it wrong. And I think what we really have to do, and this is for people who, big tent liberals, people who care about liberal institutions, who care about human freedom, have to, first of all, be willing to work with people that they disagree with on other things. Like you've got to create some big tent coalitions. And you've got to realize that the work is never done. Like human nature is just what it is. It's a mixed bag. And so it's never going to be this like, we got it, right? Done, all set. This is what human society looks like for the next 1,000 years. That's not how it works.
Yeah, right. There's this, maybe that's the other binary or part of this binary approach, is there's these two idealas, right? There's the two, the ideal of 1950s for the conservatives and the ideal of some imagined fictional future. It's, I mean, it's a fictional version of the 1950s on one hand. It's a fictional version of the future on the other hand. I think the last thing I wanted to ask you about, I've heard you talk about this before on another podcast, I think a Liberty Fund podcast, maybe you talked about Burke, Edmund Burke being part of your like intellectual tradition and kind of what you're working on, which is interesting to me because obviously, you frame a lot of what you're talking about as being, you know, you just said big tent liberals have to think about things a certain way. You're talking about, you know, in liberal institutions and the importance of liberalism. Burke is at least traditionally understood as a conservative guy, or at least in the context of like the French Revolution, he was a, you know, conservative political philosopher. Why is he maybe somebody that I guess both conservatives and liberals should be looking at today and gleaning lessons from?
Yeah. So I will. I have tried to die on this hill a number of times. I consider Burke a classical liberal. I do not consider him a conservative. He was a member of the Whig Party. His the conservative element of his thought obviously came out during the French Revolution. But that conservative thought was shared with people like Adam Smith, who I don't consider conservative. Probably progressives consider him conservative. But I think what Burke and Smith recognized is that revolution is inherently dangerous. You don't know what's on the other side. So when you throw out, right, conventions and norms, and especially when you're willing to resort to violence, you are activating parts of human nature that are really, really hard to deactivate. And so once you've done that, you've got to be ready for any possible outcome. And the results of various kinds of revolutions bear him out, right? It's not like 90% of revolutions end up in a liberal democracy. It's a much, much lower percentage, right? You're just as likely to end up in dictatorship as you are in a better situation than you are at this point. And I remember having an argument with a friend of mine about the the sort of various revolutions starting in Tunisia, whenever that was. Time has no meaning anymore. Yeah, it
feels like. Early 2000s, 2010-ish, yeah. Maybe that was, yeah.
And you know, they were viewing this as part of this progressive arc of history, yeah. Right? Like, look at these people fighting for freedom. And I said, well, I will judge it on the basis of, like, how those people are living and how free they are in a year. Like, I'm not looking at this as a good thing until I know that it actually has liberated people in a meaningful way. And it turned out that in a lot of those countries in the Arab Spring, they were not liberated in any kind of meaningful way. So anyway, to get back to Burke, you know, one of the things I love about Burke is that he's a deeply contextual thinker. I think he actually embodies a lot of the radical moderation that I try to, and I've been very influenced by him in my own work. You know, he argues for what he calls prejudice, and we use that term a lot differently than he did. But for him, it means it's natural for humans to love and to care for what is theirs. And by that, he means your family, your community, to a certain degree, your nation. And he said, but it's actually really damaging to think that you can extend that care out into the whole world. And in fact, when you do that, Smith actually makes a very similar point. When you do that, you open yourself up to all sorts of unintended consequences, not least of which is that you end up, you actually end up creating threats to your home. So for Burke, it's not that he's conservative in the sense that he's conservative across the board, or, and certainly not sort of reactionary. What he was concerned with was primarily the UK. He wanted to make sure that institutions remain strong. And he also wanted to make sure that the UK and sort of Britain, Great Britain broadly, was working to eliminate injustice. So if you look at, for example, his response to the East India Company, right? He sounds like a radical progressive, right? He's like, these corporate monsters are violating people's rights, like left and right. Like he sounds like a progressive, you know, ad for, anti-sweatshops or something, right? So his approach to the Irish was very similar. His approach to the American Revolution was very measured. He basically kept telling the, you know, Parliament as well as the king, like, hey, stop pushing them. Stop yeah. pushing their buttons because you're going to lose them, right? And so, and once the revolution happened, he was like, well, like we got what we asked for. And so the American Revolution was not, it didn't trigger the same kind of concern for him because it wasn't violent in the same way that the French Revolution was. And it didn't attack the various institutions of civil society. It didn't attack religion. It didn't attack even local laws remained in place throughout the American Revolution. That did not happen in the French Revolution. So I think Burke saw them as fundamentally like the American Revolution was just like removing this person on top and replacing it with somebody else or another group of people. Whereas the French Revolution was a bottom-up revolution that was meant to just fundamentally reshape civil society. And that was the kind of revolution that he was really deeply concerned about. And I think that's a very classical liberal attitude. Like, yeah. You don't need to destroy everything to make modest reforms.
Maybe that's a good place to end on. Last question to you here would be this, would be like, we see that mentality now, I think, on the right, this idea of tearing down institutions as a way towards this imagined utopia or some sort of conservative end game, whatever that may look like. But there's a warning there, I think, in history and maybe in Burke's own understanding of the way that works.
Yeah, I mean, this has been, I've written a couple posts because I went to a fairly conservative PhD program. I am very familiar with conservative thought. I've spent a lot of time in conservative spaces. And it strikes me as absolutely baffling that the quote unquote conservative party is so willing to engage in behaviors that undermine everything that conservatism stands for. I think that's bizarre. I think it's dangerous. And I think it's also really terrible for the conservative movement. And I think there's really important messages and lessons that conservatives can offer to the broader political conversations. But now that they've made themselves completely untrustworthy, I don't know why anyone would take them seriously. So that to me is the sort of weirdest part of this moment is how many conservatives, including a lot of conservatives I know who I would consider principled and thoughtful people, are perfectly willing to take deeply anti-conservative moves and tactics to get some outcome. It's a very non-conservative plan.
Yeah, it is. It is a difficult and somewhat depressing time to live through. But I think your writing and your thinking on this and the whole idea of radical moderation has been refreshing to me to read about and give a sort of a different way of thinking about not just the political binary, but also just the way we're approaching. Yeah, what is a very confusing time. We've got conservatives acting like radical progressives in a lot of cases. Horseshoe theory is everyday life. Yeah. Lauren Hall, thank you so much for talking to us. Where can people find your work?
They can find me on The Radical Moderate's Guide to Life on Substack. I also have the podcast that I mentioned earlier, We Made This Political. I have a mug for it. On Substack, but it's also on Apple Podcasts. And then laurenkhall.com has everything in one place. So they can look there.
Sounds good. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks.